According to a story often told among jazz musicians, when trumpet player Clark Terry first joined the Duke Ellington Orchestra in 1951, he rehearsed in his mind every complicated technical maneuver that might be expected of him. The young musician waited anxiously for instructions from the legendary bandleader, but all his new boss asked him to do was to listen. When Terry complained that anyone could just sit and listen, the ever enigmatic Ellington informed him that there's listening and then there's listening. But what I want from you is to listen. Eventually, Terry came to understand what Ellington wanted. Terry had been so preoccupied with what he might contribute to the orchestra as an individual that he had not taken time to hear what the other musicians needed. He'd not yet learned to hear the voices around him, nor to understand the spaces and silences surrounding them. Ellington knew that his young trumpeter had talent as a virtuoso, but he felt that Terry had to learn how to bring his virtuosity into harmony, literally and figuratively, with the rest of the orchestra. That from George Lipsitz in an essay titled Listening to Learn and Learning to Listen. We're about to take a journey in listening with the esteemed drummer Phil Haynes and his band Free Country. And here's one of the descriptions of the ensemble and its music making. Free Country arranges traditional songs by combining deceptively simple head arrangements with avant-garde jazz improvisation in a style often referred to as jazzgrass. Their process treats historical melodies as a looking glass into the past, reimagining them through a modern, sometimes unsettling lens. Now let's stop for a moment and explore the phrase looking glass just used here. We remember that Lewis Carroll's famed poem Jabberwocky is read by Alice in Through the Looking Glass. This poem conforms to all the rules of English grammar, but makes playful delight out of sound and meaning. The words themselves are unfamiliar, yet they sound familiar, and the poem itself conforms to a regular A-B-A-B rhyme scheme. Here's the poem's opening stanza. 'Twas brillig and the slithy toves, did gyre and gimble in the wabe, all mimsy where the borogoves, and the mome raths outgrabe. Now, the question becomes, how and why Alice and her readers understand this supposed nonsense. In the novel, Alice is confused by the poem, and we can imagine why. Something's not right, she probably thinks. 'Twas sounds like the eminently normal contraction of it was, and brillig sounds an awful lot like brilliant. Is the poem's author setting the stage for a bright and lovely day? Alas, no. Later in the story, Humpty Dumpty tells Alice that brillig means 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the time when you begin broiling things for dinner. And those slimy toves, could they be slimy toads or slithering doves? Jabberwocky seems to be a jumble of orderly nonsense. Or is it? While Alice thinks it pretty, she doesn't quite understand it. But at the same time, and here is the crucial thing, she says that somehow it seems to fill my head with ideas, only I don't know exactly what they are. In other words, Alice finds the poem not meaningless nonsense, but instead a ticklishly mysterious melody that somehow makes its way inside her. Alice is willing to entertain the thought that although she might not understand the poem, she nevertheless hears and feels the echoes of its song. Moreover, even though she doesn't fully understand the strange ideas filling her head, she nevertheless appreciates the poem's musical play of rhythm and rhyme. Alice, in other words, is able to gather together the ideas of the poem without confining them to things or schemas she already knows. Alice turns out to be willing to tolerate a bit of puzzlement, and she becomes a model of a listener who is open more or less to aspects of lived experience that don't fit our everyday routines. Lisbeth Lipari quotes composer John Cage as she contends there may just be something she calls a politics of listening. In his Reflections of a Progressive Composer on a Damaged Society, Cage describes the limitations in his view of European music, both in terms of the sounds it excludes, as well as in the structures of organization, which impose ideas and order rather than inspiring and including them. When I think of a good future, it certainly has music in it, but it doesn't have one kind of music. It has all kinds, and it goes beyond anything that I can imagine or describe. The word free is in the band's very name, and their most recent release is a double album titled Liberty Now, words rendered on the cover in a script that is very reminiscent of what we might see in Ken Burns' documentary on the American Revolution. And yes, American history is invoked, as we'll learn, but Phil Haynes and Free Country are exploring that history and the current day through the looking glass.
Only a year ago, post everyone's pandemic challenges, my quartet members each had dear loved ones unexpectedly lost, aging health and employment vulnerabilities, and then, of course, election collisions while witnessing rights being stripped away. Though each of us mingled in a long-awaited sweetness, just to gather and create anew, a project of original compositions initially thought of as our music. When first sequencing the new album's tracks just a year ago, I was startled that a timely abstract poem jumped out, just merely by reading our tune titles in order. Situation Ethnics, Pastime. Strands of Liberty, Higgins, Diaphana, Each of Us, Confetti. Corner Store Joy, Next of Kin, The Wire, Home Road, Dawn. Such collective subconscious, these coincidences, they struck me as spiritual, a call, suddenly demanding that I craft a protest album without ever planning one. That's when the group's Our Music session metamorphosed into Liberty Now, with our originals released on disc one combined with a compilation disc two, which I called from our American Trilogy releases that we had released over some three decades. Ones that chronicled U.S. pop music from the times of the Revolutionary and Civil War up through the 1960s. Clearly grouped together now, many interpretations of such popular music resonate with fresh urgency. On the other hand, the band is simply enjoyable, intimate acoustic fun, jazzily broadening the definition of a rootsy Americana string band, reframing old familiar favorites. Favorites such as old-timey ones like She'll Be Coming Around the Mountain, Simple Gifts, Joshua Fought the Battle of Jericho, or The Beatles' Revolution, Aretha Franklin's Respect, Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, and then, of course, classics like America the Beautiful, Aaron Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man, I might say common folk these days, and Louis Armstrong's What a Wonderful World. I don't have to tell you, we the people are living through historic times as our democracy is being challenged and tested. Liberty Now is our musical response, a vulnerable, sensitive, yes, protest album, poised to, we hope, help reflect, question, consider, heal, share, unify, hopefully all of us to act to save our nation's promise, let alone the world's. As the old Elvis hit intones, it's now or never, and at least we have 249 years of attested great American experiment to bolster us. So what can any of us do? Share the good. Perhaps in our homes and immediate circles of friends and colleagues. Listen, exhibit more genuine support, respectful sensitivity, and hopeful thankfulness for the life's blessings that and loves that we share. But above all, Invest in things that bring you and others joy.
Esteemed drummer and composer Phil Haynes with a poem that we might puzzle over as Alice did with hers, but at the same time, he's just prepared us to listen more deeply to the music attached to those titles and to the conversation ahead. Haynes grew up on the West Coast in Oregon, and he tells us that before he was 2 years old, he'd pulled out pots and pans to drum on, and coffee cans, too. He's a veteran artist who was based in New York for 25 years. He's toured the world. He's featured on more than 85 LP, CD, and DVD releases by numerous American and European record labels. Haynes' debut, the Paul Smoker Trio's QB with Anthony Braxton, was named the number one recording of 1985 by esteemed critic Kevin Whitehead. The international media have compared his drumming to masters Jacques Dejanet, Roy Haynes, and Elvin Jones, and his 60-plus diverse compositions to Duke Ellington, Charles Ives, Charles Mingus, and the Art Ensemble of Chicago. His performances were recently noted to be the perfect middle between tradition and avant-garde, between power and sophistication, between accessibility and adventure, standards with a new sense of drama, dynamics, and true moments of fun. Moving to central Pennsylvania in 2003, Haynes founded the nationally noted Jazzette Bucknell Chamber Series and was subsequently appointed as Bucknell University's Hochschild Jazz Artist in Residence. From 2007 to 2012, he taught courses in jazz history there, directed his multimedia new music Bucknell Interdisciplinary Improvisation Ensemble, and on and on. We had a chance to speak by phone with Phil Haynes about his life in music and Liberty Now. I wanted to ask you, when you got to New York, was everything going? Were there many streams of jazz, still bebop and others going into avant-garde playing? And were there people in between? What did you find when you got to New York in terms of the tenor of the times?
Well, I got there in the early 80s, and first as a student and then immediately moving there after I graduated my undergraduate work. And yes, you found everything. It was sort of the end of the fusion era. Jazz was calming down. You had the so-called loft scene, which was very experimental, late night sessions, just, you know, still the remnants of the free blowing from the 60s as well as everything else. I mean, most of the work was in bebop and blues and hard bop. And then, of course, classic piano trios and vocalists, and everybody was there together. And then, of course, it was the American hub of classical music and the American European avant-garde, you know, the classical avant-garde music. And so it's all circling. And none of us, of course, can get, it's all melded in, woven in together with popular music, you know, popular music of the day. And like I say, the music I grew up with that surrounded me. And so, wow. What a tapestry. And I was kind of like Ellington. There was only two kinds of music. It was either good or it wasn't. And of course, that moves sometimes a little bit as you grow up and your tastes expand. But it was really like that. And I went to New York trying to be a sideman. And so I felt like I had skills and aptitudes and certainly interest in playing a wide variety of musics. And within a few years, it became clear to me that, oh, actually, I'm really good at helping form collectives and being bloop with that, composers, collectives, et cetera. I'm good at being a leader. But as a sideman, most of the work was, say, with quiet piano trios and vocalists. And I was doing a lot of very intense sort of avant-leaning stuff that we were touring Europe and so on. And there were people that said, I'm not going to let him get near my stage. They didn't want to know that I could do the other. And I think that was one of the cruxes in the 80s and 90s. Maybe still today, there are cliques and they can't help but try to protect each other. It's like, oh, this is where our boundaries are most comfortable. And whereas I just grew up, it was either good music or it wasn't. And I had teachers that said the broader your influences and the better you are at all of it, the better your music has the potential of becoming.
Let me ask you about the seminal figure in your life and the life of so many, and that is Herb Robertson.
Yes, Herb Robertson was the first for me that I could still consider my generation. You know, he's just 10 years older than I am. And when he passed, literally as we walked the threshold into the studio and the cell phone started ringing, and it became clear it was about Herb. And at first, of course, nobody wants to play, but after two or three postponements over two or three years because of COVID and whatever, well, and Herb would want us to play. So, you know, we had all toured with him. We had all recorded with him. He was instrumental in showing me what true freedom and free music was. I had been labeled it, but it was like this guy came out of silence in a spiritual way and could make music out of anything, from toys to the building you were in to the sounds going by in the streets. Everything was fair. And of course, he was a virtuoso trumpeter and so on. And so he had a great influence on so many, because it was intoxicating if you could get with him and those who had been influenced by with him. If there were two or more in the room, an entire ensemble would be that much more open. And so whatever language you were in, you were improvising more authentically, more honestly, more spiritually. It was very interesting. So he was powerful to my quartet, Free Country, and our whole generation in New York. But boy, again, if you know all that music and you can play with the masters in those idioms and they like it, and you know, you just come out enriched, and it's kind of like a liberal arts education. All of a sudden, you just have larger perspective. And one of my early college mentors and musical colleagues, Paul Smoker, used to say, you want to know something about everything and everything about something. And while that's sort of an impossible goal, it's a helpful goal. And so these were the kinds of things going on. And Herb was also labeled a free musician, but he was a lead trumpet player. He could play in big bands. He was in the top bands coming out of Berkeley and going out on the road. And then, as was my other colleague, Paul Smoker, who would sub for Doc Severinsen when he was ill or double booked. And people sort of forget that. And then, you know, gosh, these guys could read, we used to say, bird droppings on a page. They could read anything because they were so skilled. And Herb played with all kinds of musicians internationally, from what we call the ECM, modern school, modern European, the downtown musicians, you know, Tim Vernon, Sean Zorn, and as well as some older classic musicians. It's really quite a continuum. And he's a connection to all that.
Thank you.
And so were you just subconsciously absorbing everything you'd listened to? Would you be surprised you're improvising and suddenly you might be aware that, oh, or after you play a gig and you say, oh, that was Herb, or that was my sister on the guitar doing Joni Mitchell. Does it surprise you sometimes, all that you've experienced musically just by listening and being and absorbing?
Yeah, particularly when it comes out, as you say, unexpectedly, and it makes you smile, or more particularly, it makes somebody else smile. And whether they hear the influence or not, it touches something else in their background. And again, it's this music, and certainly American pop music is something that binds all of us. We all know it. Most of us love most of it or have a relationship to all of it. It's, it's neither left or right. It just is. But whether it was the blue, I mean, America bringing, you know, the slave trade and so on, it's always been a clash of and a melting pot of European, African, and eventually all kinds of world influences. And it couldn't have happened anywhere else and come out the way it did, except in America. And it's always been a music of struggle and protest, and as well as, at least underneath it, as well as just entertainment. I'm sure there were a lot of people who listened to Billie Holiday singing Strange Fruit back in the day who it never occurred to them it was anything but a Kiwi. But the rest of us were quaking in our boots, having to deal with the reality of what was really being sung about.
Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
Phil, if we look at the graphic design of the Liberty Now double set, we might think, if we didn't know anything about what's inside and what we're going to hear, we might think, oh, Phil Haynes and Freak Country did this set in anticipation of the 250th anniversary of America, the Declaration of Independence. But you've told us already at the start how this came to be.
Yeah, you know, when the first time that Free Country got together, the days just before, and then we recorded the day after I was married, as everybody was, you know, in my community and close to Dee and I were assembled, I just thought, oh, well, if it's a great American music and people know it, and I could hear how we four people might develop it, it's, you know, this is great. And then all of a sudden, Hank Roberts, our great cellist and lead vocalist, says, Phil, I don't think any of us, certainly not four white guys playing jazz, can play Dixie and not be misunderstood. And so there were certain tunes that we couldn't do. But it was an awakening at that time that it wasn't just either good music or not good music. Now I had to worry about what the lyrics were. And once we, I started to, and then the band started worrying about what the lyrics were, we became very selective. And it influenced, of course, whether, you know, Hank was singing or not, it influenced our interpretations. But back to the design, it's kind of funny. It's not exactly black and white, but it's a black and white cover. It uses older style script. It's a little bit of the Founding Fathers script, and it's also a little bit of Max Roach Freedom Now. And freedom is the ability to do what you want, to express what you want. But liberty, I think, is the application of your right stopping the next person's nose, and how our actions, our freedoms, and how we express them need to be done in community. Do they help one another, or are there limits? And we're seeing that when our freedoms and our due process is being questioned, then so is our liberty. It's crazy.
we can have songs that are rallying cries, marches for soldiers, or to raise the spirits of a protest crowd, or Les Enfants de la Patrie, Le Jour de la Gloire est arrivé. You know, we go back to the French Revolution and all that kind of music. But what seems to be so important about what you've done here and your body of work, Phil, and what musicians of your caliber can do for us is you can help us to learn to listen. And if we are drawn in and learn to listen to you all communicating with each other and really are affected by it, my hope would be that the listening that is so absent among us by and large as a society, well, that's the kind of listening you do so well. The really deep listening to each other. Chemistry is probably a word you all use with each other in free country, but there are those moments, for example, as I was listening to Disc One, moments when you and Drew are particularly in a kind of duet situation, and it is so fresh. It's as if not just that you're listening to each other, it feels like you are so open to each other. You are yourself and he is himself. But what comes out in this conversation, this intimate conversation, is so, as they always say, greater than the sum of you as a drummer and Drew as a bassist, that it takes your breath away almost.
It is all that. And, you know, as a professional musician coming up, you want to and you learn to play with anybody else who's coming with also good intentions and coming prepared and perfect. But then you notice that some people you admire more than others. And then you notice that some of the people you admire when you play with, you know, you're either not ready or it's the chemistry isn't quite right, even if you really like each other. And then sometimes, the first time on the bandstand, your head snap. And this was what happened with Drew and I. That was one of the first times that I found chemistry in New York. And from there, I remember asking him, well, who's somebody that's special to you that you think, you know, we ought to grow from? Who do you have great chemistry with? And he led me to Ellery Askelin and then to Ben Maunder. And we had common influences in David Liebman. And we got to the point where not only could we play professionally with lots of people, but then when we noticed, I love playing duets with people. When I had great chemistry with somebody, I figured out a band that would frame them and frame myself freshly. And once I had one good band that was really clicking, then I wanted to find the next set of people to put together to frame something quite different. Some of us might be in common, but let's do a whole different kind of music. And I found a community of musicians, including these four guys, that had like aspirations, and they also valued. And so this band immediately in the studio, it was clear we had this sound, and it wasn't named Free Country until after I heard the band in the studio. And of course, we were doing this pre-1900 American popular music, and it became clear, oh, it's got this country bluegrass thing, as well as the jazz thing, and it's a string. Oh, we should call this Free Country. Thank you. chemistry was obvious, and then I realized then it wasn't just going to be for one record. I wanted to do an American trilogy moving through the 50s and then into the 60s. And then ultimately, I couldn't get the sound out of my head. And during COVID, trying to think of, well, what can I do until I can meet younger musicians again and start playing again? And I just never could get the sound of this band out of my head. And that's when, oh, we really need to go back to the idea of doing, after the American trilogy, we need to do our music instead of covers. And look at what it became.
Do you think that what I've just described about my experience of you and Drew, for example, from this album, is that something that can have an impact on a person who is listening to what you're doing and help us become better listeners in the largest sense of the word? You're so attuned to each other, and if we are tuning into what you're doing, wouldn't that be good for a democracy in a certain sense?
Well, it is. You know, the Founding Fathers, the aspirations of this country, which we, you know, don't always live up to, but we seem to basically, if you take every 30 years, we seem to be making progress for 249 years. You know, we were going in the right direction, and we certainly meant to have a good heart more and more and more. And jazz has often been compared to democracy. In order to have that kind of freedom, you have to have the responsibilities of your liberties. You have to take it seriously, and you have to notice how you affect everyone. And in an ensemble, especially when you're collectively blowing, shall we say, right, you're all improvising at once, it's really easy. When you're learning, you find that usually it sounds pretty discordant. But as you add people who are experienced and who are sensitive, that they really hear everybody first, and they're trying to hear the big picture about what they need to contribute instead of, well, I'm doing this and the other guys will figure it out. Instead, it's, you know, when you enter that zone and that flow state as an ensemble, yeah, it is a metaphor for living in this country and living in the world. And people, early on when I was playing in Paul Smoker's trio and Anthony Braxton recorded with us, it was quite jarring music to a lot of people back in the early 80s. And we noticed that people who knew nothing about jazz in America but liked music were ecstatic in our concerts, right? Didn't seem to matter what their background. They got the visceral message, right? And then when we went to Europe, people were crazy about it. When we first went to New York, since we didn't come out of New York, there was a lot of suspicion and a lot of people sitting on their hands. And that was interesting. Like, the more people know about, if they think they know a lot about music, they may or may not, and they may or may not have a reaction. But those people who are open to this beautiful balance of democracy and freedoms and liberty inherent in jazz and spontaneous composition, you know, it's like, oh, because that's all any of us are doing. We're all living our lives. We're spontaneously composing, but we're part of a huge national and world orchestra.
But you also give us a sense in the album, not just that it's all that wonderful weaving together of a tapestry out of diverse voices making something greater than the sum of the parts, but isn't it Strands of Liberty? Isn't that the piece where you might show us some of the rockiness?
Absolutely. You know, when you, all the different kinds of musical styles, if you're going to talk about liberty, the strands of liberty that we're all feeling the strain of, you're not going to do it in Mozart, you know, Marriage of Figaro language. You're not going to do it in the Beatles' Yesterday's language. And so, yeah, you put guys in a place where, you put musicians in a place where you're using very strident sounds and avant-leaning sounds. And you instruct the people to go divergent ways, and you find a way. I tried to find a way simply compositionally to combine them in such a way that it feels like all this strife. There's a point where we all drop out and only Jim on guitar is playing, and he's playing this manic, crazy nonsense. Then it stops, and then the ensemble comes back together in this unity, right? One voice at a time, and we're together again. So you need all those expressions to weave those tapestries. And I think people at least subconsciously get it if they sit down and listen. And they certainly, when it's familiar to them, they get it. It's like, oh, I always want to leave breadcrumbs with my titles, you know, how to access the music and what we were thinking about and what we were trying to create. So, yeah.
It's clear we listened to disc one and you described what was happening as you all entered the studio, getting news of losing Herb, and then the political ramifications of the fall of 2024, and that couldn't help but be in your playing, at the way that there would be something about that you couldn't peel away. You didn't want to play, but you had to, and Herb would have wanted you to play. Then you put in disc two, and suddenly it's like, oh, this is a different feeling. The clouds have parted.
Oh, how lovely. I'm so glad it hit you that way. You know, Herb's passing and the times, the political times you just referenced, they colored the session. And of course, as artists, it became clear to me when I was listening back in January last year and trying to put together an album. And it was so vulnerable. It was so sensitive. I mean, the music had always been sensitive and always been kind of translucent, but now it had this special vulnerability because we were all hurting. And we didn't really want to play, except we were so excited to see each other and to finally get to do this thing that we had planned off and on for several years, well, actually for about a decade. Would we do it? Would we not? And all of a sudden it hit me. It was like between reading the titles and then hearing the music and going, oh, it's in there. That vulnerability, that translucence, that sensitivity, that pathos, that deep hurt is throughout all the interpretations, even when they're happy songs in the first disc of the new originals recording from a year ago in December. And the earlier discs were made at a much different time. I know, you know, Revolution, you know, when we covered that, we were doing a live record to see how we would be able to handle the Beatles stuff. And so, you know, you can't do a 60s record with a band that can't cover the Beatles, you know, as far as I was concerned. It was sort of a test. And you hear the optimism. We were in the Obama years, and it's joyful and boisterous and, you know, whatever. And yet, of course, we all know what the lyrics are, but it was this, oh, we're getting somewhere in our revolution. And if we were to interpret that today, it would have felt quite different. It would have had to. Anyway, it became clear we weren't tone deaf. And, you know, you don't want to be an artist who, well, I'm just going to keep making my records. Well, you know, if they're not affected by the time and you're not transmitting and communicating your age's struggles as well as things that to rejoice about, and you just said it, you know, when the clouds part, America, there's so much to be proud of. And that's why it hurts so much with what's going on today, because it seems like we're backtracking.
And what you've just said there, wasn't that what Armstrong was doing in What a Wonderful World, or what he said about it, that he wasn't being rose-colored glasses, that we can acknowledge that there's something wonderful, but it's fraught as well?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, Louis was criticized in his own community for that song. And he was called at various times in his career. He was both a statesman and going out and representing, you know, America at State Department worldwide. He was an ambassador, but he was also called an Uncle Tom by some forces. And if you look at the lyrics, I see skies of blue, clouds of white, the colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. Now, how can you call that Uncle Tom? I mean, he sees the skies of blue, which of course, blue, black, right? The African experience, the blues, amongst clouds of white, right? The culture that brought them to this country forcibly. But it's really the colors of the rainbow that's emerging, and it's so pretty in the sky, right? He made that song. He got it. He clearly was a protest musician. We all find ourselves in unique circumstances, and of course, we're unique individuals with But he spoke just as clearly as Billie Holiday had with Strange Fruit.
Is that a good song to leave with as we air this, as the country has just marked Martin Luther King Jr. Day?
Well, it's what we ended Liberty Now with. And as you know, it's two big fat CDs, this journey, this odyssey through American folk song and popular song. And I can't imagine any greater way to honor Martin Luther King Day and all the masters that brought Africa's magic and combined it with European magic and American magic and now give to the world. And I think there's a lot of hope in it. What a wonderful world as interpreted by the ensemble Free Country. We heard from esteemed drummer, composer Phil Haynes speaking with us about Liberty Now, a double album that drew on songs from their American trilogy as well as new original material. The release is on Corner Store Jazz, and we want to remind you that Phil Haynes founded the nationally noted Jazz at Bucknell Chamber Series. He was appointed as Bucknell University's Cultural Jazz Artist in Residence from 2007 to 2012. He taught courses there in jazz history and did many more things. He coached the university jazz band, and he led the Bison Band. And in recent years, he had appointments as interim director of jazz studies, both for Susquehanna University and Nazareth College in New York. That's Phil Haynes and Free Country. The band members are, in addition to Phil Haynes, drums, percussion, Hank Roberts, cello, vocals, Jim Yanda, guitar, Drew Gress, acoustic bass. And for more information on the web, PhilHaynes.com, PhilHaynes.com, H-A-Y-N-E-S, PhilHaynes.com, or CornerStoreJazz.com, CornerStoreJazz.com.